Our shiur tonight, our discussion will be focused on halachic issues in travel. And that's travel in general, but specifically we want to focus on traveling east. And we'll talk a little about Thailand. One of the classical problems with travel is the melacha of hotzah on Shabbos in many places in the world. If you're not in major Jewish communities, there's no Eruv. And therefore, it's very important to notify the public that they should be careful before they leave their house on the way to shul, wherever they're going on Shabbos. Make sure that they're clean, they have nothing in any of the pockets. I myself was witness once in Europe when I saw an Israeli leave his hotel room proudly carrying his talis zekel in his hand on the way to shul. Little did he know, because he's so used to every city in Israel having an Eruv, that in Europe, there, in that particular place, I think it was in Spain, there was no Eruv. So we have to notify the public about that. Quite common, there's an issue of using elevators. That applies if you're staying in a hotel on a higher floor. You have to use the elevator to get to your room. How do you get there on Shabbos when you're not allowed to press the button of the elevator? Or, for example, if you're visiting someone on a high floor, this issue came up recently. My wife and I were traveling, and we were staying on the 35th floor of a building. What do you do about the elevator? In Israel, it's common, and it becomes more and more common with the passage of time, that we have a Shabbos elevator that's programmed to stop at every floor. There, we have a clear heter, there's no problem. But if you're in a place where there is no Shabbos elevator, what do you do? And in the case of a hotel room, of course, what you have is an issue of how to get up to your floor. As I said before, ratsui, the best possible scenario would be to stay on ground floor, or at least to stay on a floor where you can access and get up there by walking up the steps. But in cases where, let's say, going into the stairwell where the staircase is, you would have to turn on the light. There's some sort of infrared system and the lights go on. This could be true even when you get up to the floor of your hotel, and possibly even when you enter into your hotel room. You have these issues of gram hafolas ha-chashmal. You are causing the electricity to go on. Assuming that you can solve those problems, the easiest way of solving any problems of electricity is if the guy is doing this for himself. So if, let's say, you can attach yourself to a guy and go in his footsteps, who's walking up and activating the lights in the corridor in which your hotel room is, then you haven't turned on the lights, he did. In the case of hotels that require that the only way you can get the electricity going in your hotel room is by putting the hotel card into the slot, or for that matter, opening your door will require some sort of electric recognition of your, you know, you have to ask about this at the hotel lobby before you book yourself, or the hotel reception desk, if they have the opportunity of giving you a key to the room, and then to organize electricity before Shabbos so that only certain lights go on. In the case of the elevator, it's quite complicated, because if the guy, let's say, for example, there's a doorman at the building or at the hotel reception, then for you to tell him to do this violation for you of activating the elevator would be a amir liakum. We're not allowed to ask a guy to do a malacha for us on Shabbos. In fact, I would go even a step further. We're not allowed to enjoy the benefits of a malacha that was done on our behalf, even if we don't have to instruct the guy. Although there may be two different levels of the violation of amir liakum, the more severe violation has both dimensions to it. You instruct the guy verbally, and at the same time, the guy is doing this malach on your behalf. So you have a double entendre. That's tarte l'reis. So if you lower it one level, the guy does this on his own, but he does it not for himself, but rather for you. You're benefiting from a malach that was done by a guy on your behalf. In the case of the doorman, it would seem clear that even if you were to tell the doorman before Shabbos, or if he's, you know, he sees you regularly and he knows exactly when you come into the building that you need the elevator and he knows which floor to press for you, he's still doing a malacha on your behalf, and that is an issue. At the same time, let's say you went up to your floor, let's say you're visiting relatives, then if they have a maidservant who works for them, a non-Jewish woman or non-Jewish man for that matter, and he presses the elevator for you on your behalf, again, he's doing a malacha on your behalf. I saw online recently a presentation of a Rabbi David Sperling. I don't know him. I think he teaches in Nishmat, if I'm not mistaken, or perhaps in Midrashat Lindenbaum, I don't know. He has a piece here called Non-Shabbos Elevator on Shabbos. And after thanking the questioner for raising this question about an elevator in a hotel, and the non-Jew pushing the elevator button on behalf of the Jew, he points out that if a non-Jew is using the elevator for themselves, you're allowed to join them. So let's take, for example, the case I gave you before. You're on the 35th floor, and you're on your way down. If, let's say, the non-Jew is going to take care of one of the children, the young children, and at 10 a.m., the non-Jewish maidservant, let's say, will take the children down for a walk in the park, because that's what the little children need to do to get some fresh air and go out in the park. It could be that in such a case you can join in as what I call in Yiddish a nachschlepper, because you are really enjoying the benefit of the malach that's being done by the non-Jew. Although, arguably, the non-Jew is doing that malach and not for themselves, but also for on behalf of the children who are Jewish. But that might be less of a problem. Now, there is a halacha called Shas HaDchak, which Rabbi Sperling mentions here in his presentation. That means in a time of great need. Obviously, if you're on vacation and there are various options, you don't have to take a hotel that's going to give you a room up on the 25th floor. There are ways of organizing your vacation on the ground floor. But if, on the other hand, you're visiting people, for example, or the only hotel room available in that area is on the 35th floor, the people you're visiting live on the 35th floor, you need what's called the heter of great need. Now, what constitutes great need? That's not very, very simple and very easy to define. What constitutes shas hadchak? There's so many different factors and considerations, maybe financial, maybe religious needs, going to shul, visiting a family where you feel you can enjoy their company, they can get to know you as a member of your family, you very rarely get to see them, they live abroad in a far-off place, a far-off country, maybe it's a chizuk, together to serve, to observe the Shabbos and make the Shabbos table into a beautiful table, maybe perhaps going to shul would be a great need. There are many different ways of defining this in different gradations. What about on the way up? Let's say, for example, there's a hired professional doorman, and he's in charge not just for you, for your benefit, but for other benefits, to make sure that people are serviced and they can get into the elevator, they can get up to the floor. You don't have to tell them, they'll recognize you. Perhaps your family has notified them before Shabbos, and they will not be there's no need, you don't have to tell them, there's no explicit enunciation and instruction to press the elevator. So they do that on their own, but then they're doing it on your behalf. Now the question becomes, are we dealing with a malacha d'oraisa or a malacha d'rabbanan? This touches on a few different issues. One, about electricity in general. What's its status as far as Shabbos is concerned? Is it meleches bones and meleches mavir? Is it a d'oraisa? Is it a d'rabbanan? Maybe it's grama, in the sense that you're pressing a button and you're freeing an electric impulse. Can we reduce the nature of the Isur, had it been done by a Jew, from a Doraisa to a Drabanan? If we're dealing with a Drabanan, then we certainly have more room for leniency in cases of great need. Again, as we discussed before, that's not always easy to determine what is and what constitutes Shas HaDchak that would perhaps override this Isur. If we can assume the following conditions. Number one, that in the worst case scenario, hafalat, hamalit, to press the button is only a violation of the Rabban. If we can assume number two, that we haven't told or instructed the doorman explicitly, he knows what to do on his own, that also reduces the nature of the Isur. Here we want to add a third element in the discussion, and then finally, the Makabe Patish, the last element is going to be Shas HaDchak, and that is that the doorman might be classified as a Kablon rather than a Poel. A Poel is, in a sense, owned almost like an Eved by the person who's hiring him and paying his salary. And therefore, every pa'ula that he does, every action is done on behalf of the balabais. He's an eved, he's like the extension of his arm. And in the case of a kablon, it's a little bit more complicated. He's not really his eved. And in that sense, the kablon, really, his pa'ulos are not owned by the balabais. His time is not owned by the balabais. He just has to do X number of jobs and complete those jobs whenever he can do so. And it could be that the doorman has many, many different jobs, and he might come under a kablon. You might add that even if you call him a poel, who's working on behalf of the Jew, but who's paying his salary? So, for example, in the case of visiting a family, the family is paying rent, and included in that rent, they tag on a cost to pay for the doorman. In the case of a visitor, he's not shelling out for the doorman. The doorman is doing it because the doorman has to do that. He's not working as a poel on your behalf because you're just a visitor. These are some of the guidelines, perhaps, that could help with the situation of an elevator. If it's a Shas HaDchak, as we said before, you're visiting family, it's on the 35th floor, it's impossible to go through the steps up and down, and not only that, you'll activate electricity and the lights in the stairwell, and you have to get to shul. All the above might constitute Shas HaDchak. Now I'd like to discuss with you more of a kashrus issue, and something that is fascinating in terms of traveling towards Bangkok. The Thai people from Thailand have a very popular dish which they eat, which is called sticky rice. Sticky rice is a certain kind of a grain of rice which is blended with sweeteners like mango juice or coconut milk. All the ingredients seem to be kosher. And if you can guarantee, and we'll have to see exactly how you do so, that all the ingredients are kosher, it would seem that you'd be allowed to eat this. Barring another halachic issue, which I want to discuss with you, called Bishul Akum. In terms of kashrus, the issue that obviously makes this almost impossible to eat sticky rice is that the vendor who's selling you the sticky rice used his utensil to cook the rice. And that utensil was no doubt used for non-kosher materials, and there's a blia, and therefore the rice becomes asur. However, in certain parts of Thailand, and this I saw with my own eyes, instead of preparing and cooking the rice in a metal container, they cut up a piece, a very long, thick piece of bamboo. Bamboo is more or less empty or hollow in the inside, and they slice it, I would say about 8 inches long. That bamboo serves a double function. The rice is cooked in the bamboo, and not only that, the bamboo then serves as a receptacle. The person who buys the sticky rice will eat the rice from the bamboo stick. I saw this with my own eyes, and I began to realize that this could possibly solve the kashrus issue. Why? Because kalim is not an issue. This bamboo is chadpami, and assuming that they cook, which you have to check out and be aware of, they cook the rice inside the bamboo has no bli of isur. And if you can verify with your own eyes that what goes into the bamboo is simply rice, mango, and coconut oil, coconut milk, then you know that all the kashrus issues are solved. How do they heat up rice in a piece of bamboo? The bamboo is going to go up in smoke. They suspend the bamboo over the coals. And let's assume again that you can check out it. You know the coals don't have any be'en of some sort of tarfus. And if there was any tarfus there, it was long ago burnt out with libun. And now you know that all the elements are kosher. Again, can you rely on the vendor? Well, we have something in halacha relying on a non-Jewish chef that's called a kfela, and we have ways of testing to make sure he's honest about it, because if he tells me that there's no taste of a certain non-kosher ingredient, and then I go ahead and I taste it and I find out that he lied to me, he's going to lose his job. I don't know if that's the case in a vendor who's selling you sweet rice, or call it sticky rice in a bamboo stick, because in that case, he might tell you it's got nothing but mango in it, and you'll find out that that's not true. How are you going to prove that, and how can you endanger or jeopardize his job? So I don't know if you should be relying on this Thai vendor who's selling you some sticky rice. Could be there are other members of the crew there that have no vested interest, and they'll tell you exactly how the rice is made and what goes into one of the ingredients. Or, even better, you can see as they put the ingredients inside the bamboo. But again, the bamboo cannot be placed directly over the fire. It'll go up in smoke. So what they do is they suspend it, and the heat and the vapors from the barbecue will slowly cook the rice. It's a slow cooking that takes 3 hours. But now again, assuming we've solved all the kashrus issues, we have now the issue of Bishul Akum. Now, with regard to Bishul Akum, the Gemara establishes in Masechta Avodah Zarah, and these are the sugyas on Daf Lamed Ches, and also on Daf Nun Tes, that is an issue which the Chachamim instituted called Bishul Akum. And the reason for that gzera is because of what's called chasnus, meaning that there's a certain kiruv hadas, a certain close relationship between someone who cooks for you and yourself. And if the guy is going to cook for you, that creates an intimacy. Chazal wanted to establish a certain richuk, a certain separation that would separate the Jews from the non-Jews. Now here we have the opinion of the Shach. The Shach is of the opinion that a shivcha who's working for the sake of her wages, in that case there's no kiruv hadas, because the act of Bishul is not being done as some sort of intimacy or friendship for the sake of Avas HaYisrael, but rather for the sake of making a living. That's not kiruv hadas. Now, it's not clear at all that we rely on the Shach Halacha L'maisa. There are those who are machmir. It would seem that amongst the machmir is the Ramah himself, which means that a shivcho is working as a maid in your house is not allowed to cook. You have to solve the problem of Bishul Akum. However, I wanted to suggest that even the Rambam would agree in the case of a vendor who doesn't know you from Adam, and you just happen to pass by their geschäft, and they're selling you, in this case, sticky rice, there's no kiruv hadas here whatsoever. And if you've solved, as we said before, all the issues of kashrus, maybe there's no bishul akum problem. But let's assume, for the time being, that we cannot solve the problem of bishul akum by saying there's no kiruv hadas because he's selling it to you, and he doesn't know you, and there's no relationship whatsoever. But nevertheless, if we're going to be machmir on that, we might be able to solve the problem of bishul akum in a different way. And that is, there are two conditions established by the sugya in order to prohibit bishul akum. Bishul akum is not all-inclusive, absolute. It requires condition number one, that it should be a foodstuff that eino nechal chai, cannot be eaten raw. There's a kiruv hadas when there's bishul that makes something that's non-edible into edible. And number two, it has to be olal shulchan melachim. It has to be a significant enough food that it would appear as part of the main course in a very significant meal. Things like desserts and the like are not included in bishul akum, even if they cannot be eaten raw, and you fulfill the first condition, but you haven't fulfilled the second condition that generates the isur bishul akum, namely eino olal shulchan melachim. And therefore, if you talk about mango and coconut, I would have to assume that the juices that come out of a mango and the milk that comes from a coconut is not olal shulchan melachim, but you might discuss the orez, the rice itself. Now, classically, rice would not be part of a main meal. However, this concept of olal shulchan melachim is what we call relative. It depends upon the place and the time. So, for example, potatoes. Back in the day, potatoes was considered eino olal shulchan melachim. There was no problem if the guy would cook a potato for you, even though it's eino nechal chai, but it's not olal shulchan melachim. But today, things have changed, and you go to the fanciest weddings, and they'll present you the main course, a piece of steak, a piece of chicken, and on the side is cooked rice. Rice became olal shulchan melachim. I'm sorry, I meant to say potatoes. So they'll serve you potatoes in any way, shape, or form. I don't know about rice. Maybe rice is also olal shulchan melachim. But the poskim say that olal shulchan melachim is not only relative to time, it's relative to location. And in Thailand, rice is a major staple, and therefore it's olal shulchan melachim. Very difficult to eat rice in Thailand and claim, well, there's no bishul akum because it's eino olal shulchan melachim. However, there is another way of solving this problem, and that is because the Isur Bishul Akum only applies if the entire process of Bishul was done and accomplished by the guy. If the Jew steps in, even B'techilah, so he starts the process of Bishul, even the end of the process of Bishul, that removes the Isur Bishul. So, for example, Halacha states that Hiniach Goy Basar O Kedera Al Gabi Ha'eshu Bo Yisov HaHafach Be Basar O Hegis Be Kedera Mutar. So, assuming the Goy, if you get there early enough to see all the ingredients, and therefore you know it's kosher, and early enough to pick up the bamboo and take it away from its suspended location on top of the Gecholim, on top of the coals, and then put it back down again, that would be Mutar. That would remove the Isur Bishul Akum. However, that's only applicable, according to some poskim, if it's not cooked yet. If it's already been cooked, which is called an halacha kimeichel ben josai, at least according to one group of poskim, that would be considered already mavushal, and therefore the Jew is no longer actively participating or contributing to the bishul b'sofa, because the sofa is already passed. It's already completely cooked once it reaches the state of kemeichel ben josai. However, there is a prechadash who seems to assume that any action on the part of a Jew that somehow contributes, in, even in the smallest sense, and even if the food has reached the state of kemeichel ben josai, is enough to remove the Iser of Bishalaku. I had a discussion with one of the Ravs, the Rabbonim HaMachshirim in Thailand. I told him about this bamboo sticky rice. He had not been aware of it, even though he's pretty much full-time in kashrus in Thailand. And he was very interested and curious about it. He said he was going to investigate it. I told him that I thought that you can solve the problem of Bishul Akum, assuming you know everything is kosher, in a different sort of way. Because back in the day, I don't know if this is true today, in canned tuna fish, and the tuna is obviously cooked, it's not sushi, it's not raw, the heter that kashrus organizations used or relied upon, and I think at one point in time the OU did as well, I'm not sure today, is what's called ishun. There are many different ways of cooking. When Chazal instituted gzera, like the case of Bishul Akum, it's got to be a milsa de shchicha. It's got to be the normal classical way of bishul. There are many other forms of bishul. There's kavush, which is soaking, is harei kimavushal. There's maliach, harei kuroseach. There's also something called ishun, where vapors of steam will heat. So that what they do with the tuna fish is they don't even place it into the boiling water. The boiling water emits a vapor that goes high up in the air, and the tuna fish is brought through these vapors, and that steaming process is enough to cook the tuna fish. Here in the case of our sticky rice in Thailand, the rice is not directly placed over the fire, but as we said before, it's suspended in the air above the barbecue, and the vapors, the hot steam, is cooking the sticky rice. So that might be the heter of Mu'ushan, which in many contexts would be considered Bishul, but perhaps as far as Bishul Akum is concerned, it's not included in the normal classical way of Bishul, and therefore it's not Bishul Akum. So we have many different ways, perhaps, of solving the issue of Bishul Akum, and many, many conditions would have to be met, but assuming, in theory, you could meet all these conditions, you might be able to be eating, on your next trip to Thailand, sticky rice in bamboo sticks. And as far as corn is concerned, well, you can buy corn in the streets of Thailand, as you can do in many cities in the world. The question only is whether or not there's a problem with Bishul Akum. Now, again, you have to clarify that the corn is not coming into contact with any sort of butter, because the butter is a treif, and there's no tarfus on the barbecue itself. And then, as far as Bishul Akum is concerned, if you can get there early enough, and the non-Jew will allow you to lift the corn and put it back down again while it's still cooking, or if we want to fall back on the pre-chadash, I'll read to you the pre-chadash. His language in Yoredei Siman Kuf Yud Gimel is that Bedin Hiniach Akum VeGomer Yisrael Yesh Machlokas HaPosukim BaZevedaiti DeStama Komer Leila Shas Umayri Afilu Kshigia LeMichael Ben Josoy Al Yedei Anochas HaGoy DeKeim De Leka Siluk Meal Gabia Eish Mahani Gmar Yisrael. So when the Jew turns it over, he now participates in Bishul. This is not a heter for Sfaradim. The Machaber is much more machmir in the area of Bishul Akum. It's one of the exceptional cases where the Ramah for Ashkenazim is more mekil. But nevertheless, we have a number of possibilities. Perhaps in the case of a vendor, where it's a professional matter of cooking for money and not for kiruv hadas, not of avos Yisrael, maybe there's no iser of Bishul Akum. The question of whether rice relative to the place you're in is called olal shulchan malach, and that's a weaker link in this whole structure. The question of whether or not ishun might be mutter, and it's not called Bishul in this context. The question whether Israel could step in and participate in the Bishul before it's Gemar Bishulo, all these are possibilities, but of course everything is predicated on the assumption that all the ingredients are kosher, and you're absolutely sure of that. A much more fascinating issue with regard to travel to the East in the case of Thailand, for example, is Buddhism, meaning the Isra Avodah Zarah. A lot of what they expect you to do and what maybe you expect to do as a tourist in Thailand, in Bangkok or any other city in Thailand, is to visit the treasuries and the various native and luxurious sanctuaries for Buddhism. Buddhism is the major religion of the East, and especially in Thailand, it's considered one of the world's leading religions in terms of the number of adherents that it has, the influence that it has, perhaps, and the geographic distribution. Now, this question of whether Buddhism is Avodah Zarah or not, because we're not allowed to enter into a place that's dedicated for Avodah Zarah, we're not allowed to benefit in any way from Avodah Zarah. In fact, there's a possibility, as we'll see in the postgim, that you're not allowed to even visit a city in which there are temples for idol worship. I did a little bit of research. Again, I'm not an expert in Buddhism. What do Buddhists really believe in? And what we found was that in many, many presentations, Buddhism is presented not as idol worship, but as a belief in the teachings of Buddha. The founder of Buddhism was Siddhartha Gautama. He was born in the area of Nepal, which is probably around India, that area around 600 BC. And the essence of his teachings has to do with what's called Maya, which is a word that refers to the illusionary nature of the world, or Kama, which is the cause and effect ethics. So the ultimate goal that Buddhists believe in is to achieve Nirvana, which is enlightenment. And this individual was brought up, Siddhartha, in a very wealthy house, and his parents wanted to keep him insulated and spared from the influence of the outside world and from pain and from suffering. But as we know today in contemporary life, it's very difficult to raise a child sheltered. And finally, at one point, the outside influence of the world penetrated into the heart and soul of Gautama. And during his period of time growing and maturing, he had visions, and all these visions led him to decide that he would take upon himself an ascetic lifestyle. You know, it's abandon the life of wealth, affluence, and the pursuit of pleasure, and instead to pursue enlightenment through austerity. He became very skilled in self-mortification, meaning to deny himself pleasures, and dedicated himself intensely to meditation. He was quite a leader. People, his peers, looked up to him, and eventually, on one final occasion, he experienced enlightenment, and he overcame his travails, his temptations. He achieved this state of enlightenment, and he began to teach his disciples. He had five major disciples. And what leads a person to achieve enlightenment? This he calls the middle of the way. We know it from the Rambam. And that is not luxurious indulgence, and not on the other extreme self-mortification, but something down the middle. And he preached various truths. Number one, he said that we have to follow a path of intention, of action, of effort, of meditation, of concentration, and basically we have to overcome all these temptations in life and to achieve the peaceful existence. There's a lot of morality and ethics in his teachings. And the emphasis here is going to be on nobility, on being noble, in a sense, denying one's own self for the sake of others. And there's no relationship here in his teachings to belief in God in one way or the other. But basically, in classical Buddhism, there is a certain silence about atheism, about the denial of God's existence. But be that as it may, is there idol worship here? Well, if you're talking about Buddhism as a philosophy, Buddhism in its original form, as was left by Buddha himself, we're not really talking about any sort of idol worship whatsoever. In fact, the Buddha never considered himself to be a god, any sort of divine being. He considered himself to be a way shower to teach others how to achieve enlightenment. And in that sense, really, Buddhism is not idol worship. Now, I was able to, you know, to pull out a very extensive essay here on entitled "Are Buddhists Idol Worshippers?" And he writes that it's quite customary amongst Buddhists to keep images of Buddha, to pay respect to the Buddha, but nevertheless, Buddhists are not idol worshippers. Idolatry means erecting images of gods and goddesses in shapes and size and pray directly to these images. And those prayers are requests that are guided towards the idol, and the gods and these shapes and idols are asked to bestow health and wealth and so forth and so on. But that's not what worshipping a Buddha doll is. The worshipping of the Buddha image is quite different. They revere the image of Buddha. That's a gesture to really revere and respect the greatest, wisest, and most benevolent, compassionate, holy man who ever lived in this world. And the worship of Buddha means really just paying homage and veneration and devotion to what he, the Buddha, represents, but not to attribute to the stone or to the metal figure some sort of power, and not to pray to the stone or the idol. In other words, Buddha himself was opposed to idol worship. So the image is really nothing more than a visual aid which helps one recall the teachings of Buddha, to remember his qualities, and to be inspired by the Buddha. Buddhists use the statue as a symbol or an object of concentration to gain a state of peace of mind. When a Buddhist looks upon the image of Buddha, he puts aside thoughts of strife, but rather he replaces them with thoughts of serenity, of peace, of calmness, of tranquility. The statue is there only to enable the mind to recall this great man, to inspire the devotee to follow his example and his instructions. And the devout Buddhist feels the presence of Buddha, of his master, and that makes the act of Buddhism more vivid and significant. Therefore, a true, genuine understanding of Buddhism never expects or even justifies a Buddhist to ask favors from the image or to request forgiveness for evil from the image, but just to control your mind and follow the Buddha's advice to get rid of all worldly miseries, to find salvation and nirvana, that state that we discussed before. So those who criticize Buddhists for practicing idol worship are really misinterpreting what the Buddhist really does. The mashal here he gives is people who keep photographs of their parents and grandparents to cherish their memory. And people may keep photographs of kings, queens, prime ministers, great heroes, philosophers, poets. This is not idol worship. There is certainly no reason why Buddhists cannot keep their beloved master's picture or image to respect and remember him. Now, I have another piece over here, which, again, there are many, many pages here. I can't share all of them with you. But one is a question and answer kind of blog. In this case, the question was posed to Andrew First, who's a Buddhist meditation teacher, an author, and a poet. Why do Buddhists worship idols when Buddha himself was against idol worship? And basically, if I understand correctly, what this Andrew First is going to present is a psychological reason why people needed to worship these idols of Buddha. And the reason for that is because really Buddhism means to turn to yourself and work on your own ego. But a person is insecure. He doesn't have the ability to focus on himself. And therefore, this is a pitfall. And Buddhism technically is absolutely opposed to idol worship, but yet, as a result of these images and icons, Buddhists will fall into a trap for at least a portion of their practice. Now, it could be that Buddhism itself is not Avodah Zarah, but these idols and these images now become Avodah Zarah for those Buddhists who worship them. Now, I personally would accept the thesis that there is a kind of a bow. I don't call it Hishtachava, but I call it just a bow of respect, which Buddhists will give you, like you enter into a hotel, or even if you're a vendor, the first thing they do with a big smile on their face is they bow to you, they put their hands together in a triangular form, the fingers against the fingers, and I wouldn't call that idol worship. This guy doesn't know you from a whole world, he's not worshiping you, but there's an act of reverence. But on the other hand, what I did see was these kind of altars, almost, I don't know what to call them, they're very small in most cases, and they're rampant all over the place. I almost want to call it a bamas yachid, if you know what I mean. And what they do is, on a daily basis, usually in the morning hours, they bring to this little miniature temple, and I didn't see any Buddhas in there, any images or idols, but they bring to it food, the most beautiful food, beautifully presented and decorated. They leave it there in front of this little mini temple. We were curious, my wife and I, about who eats the fruits or the vegetables or the food that they place there. One person said it's the monks that eat it. I don't know. I can't vouch for that one way or the other. Now, halacha l'maisa, in terms of visiting their temples, I would say the following. There's a very extensive collection of sources of Maror Mekomos about Avodah Zarah and visiting places of worship of other religions that was put together by the group called Olamot.net. That's Rabbi Reisman's his site online. And you could look that up. And he addresses, collecting all these sources that address a myriad of issues regarding Avodah Zarah, issues about visiting Catholic churches, and so forth and so on. And he has a number of poskim, some of which we may have time, I don't know, depending on time, to quote and study about seeing the outside of these structures, just for the sake of appreciating the art and the architecture of the structure. And he has also a long discussion about Islam and their misgadim, and whether their misgadim has the same status as a base Avodah Zarah, or maybe because they believe in one God, therefore they know that's not Islam is not considered Avodah Zarah. Christianity might depend upon Catholicism versus Protestant religion, so forth and so on. And the issue also comes up about visiting a chater of a temple for idol worship, just the outside, to get a picture of the beauty of the chater or the nof. That's where you can get a view of the nof, the view, and so forth and so on. And basically, there are heterim for visiting cities that have temples for idol worship. If you're going there, not for the sake of the Avodah Zarah, but simply because it's a good place to visit or to do business and so forth and so on. But as far as entering into a makom Avodah Zarah, that's prohibited. And the chatzar might be permissible, according to many poskim. As far as viewing the outside structure, so let me just see if I can quote to you some of the poskim here. Moshe Feinstein in his Tshuvas, which you'll see here in Olamot.net on page 6, in Simon, in Yoredei Chelek Aleph, Simon Kuf Chav Tes, he writes about the Isur Leikanes, entering into a church in order to enjoy the artistic creations. The implication is that he's dealing with entering into, but not a prohibition of seeing it on the outside. In other words, the structure, the architectural structure, is not itself a chefetz of avodah zarah that you're benefiting from, but the iser is knisa, not enjoyment. Okay, these are some of the issues that we discussed, and there's a lot more, but we spoke about kashrus, about elevators, about bishul akum, and about avodah zarah. All right, we'll stop here.